What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It has been 422 days since October 7th, 2023. Since that time, the undercount of the number we've received is that 45,226 Palestinians have been murdered. We spent most Mondays of the last year, plus of genocide, hosting Palestine Post, where we take the entire hour to beat back the false narratives and misinformation and disinformation that is helping to fuel this iteration of genocide, along, of course, with U.S. dollars and weapons. We continue that coverage today. Our first guest, I think we can call a regular on the show at this point, is Curry Peterson-Smith, Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches U.S. border, empire, and migration. Good morning, Curry.
Good morning, Kat. I'm always grateful to join you.
Always happy that I'm always happy that you're coming on the air. I'm never happy about what we talk about.
Right.
And I want to start actually our conversation with what we haven't done a couple times because we were really so wrapped up in who was going to be president of the United States, and right. That is with the humanity and the sitting in the fact that it's been 422 days. In the undercount of a number is 45,226, and actually, I have other numbers that were super disturbing in terms of like 11,000 people missing. You go ahead.
Yeah, you know, whenever we do talk about this, we talk about how the toll here, you know, on individuals, on families, on Palestinian society, on the planet, you know, which Israel's also destroying. It's really indescribable. You know, it's impossible to really appreciate it all. And so I want to offer one angle for understanding this. And that is actually the contrast between the rhetoric of what this White House has been saying versus where things are actually at in Gaza. Because, you know, it's wild to think about. Actually, this time last year, a year ago, I believe the timing, you know, if I've got the timing right, we were coming off of a temporary pause, a ceasefire, which was a tiny bit of respite for Palestinians in Gaza, you know, between horrific Israeli bombings, and which, by the way, was the single greatest moment of the release of Israeli hostages, you know, in an agreement that Hamas honored last year, right? And since then, we had last January the International Court of Justice say Israel is plausibly in violation of the Genocide Convention here. We have evidence for that, and it must take all steps to stop this violence. And the U.S. was also bound, as are all U.N. states, you know, U.N. member states, to take action to stop this violence. And the weapons transfers continued. And I just think about all the times that President Biden said, oh, a ceasefire is right around the corner. It's going to happen. Fast forward to today. And it's, you know, there's the numbers, which as you mentioned, Kat, the numbers we have don't do justice. I mean, numbers can never really do justice. But we know that we have an undercount in terms of the number of folks killed. And we can go through the many horrific, gruesome statistics, the number of people maimed, the number of children orphaned, you know, et cetera. But it's not just the numbers, it's the quality of life. It's people drinking from puddles because there is no water infrastructure. It's been destroyed, you know. It's people foraging for food that's not there. And the thing I just want to conclude this point on is this morning, actually, the New York Times reported that Israel appears to be establishing more or less permanent military bases in the middle of Gaza. And it just flies in the face of everything that those forces have said and everything that this White House has said. You know, when you put aside all their rhetoric about we're respecting international law and honoring human rights, you actually take a look at the Gaza Strip, where they are making life impossible and a place uninhabitable, especially in northern Gaza. And far from being right around the corner from a ceasefire, Israel's actually trying to set up shop permanently their military forces in Gaza. That is the reality we're looking at today.
And just for my listeners, there's an excellent opinion piece about this in Al Jazeera called "There Are No Humanitarian Zones or Evacuation Orders in Gaza" by the CEO of Action for Humanity, Othman Makbel. All right, Curry, I don't have you for the whole hour, and there's lots to talk about, specifically developments in Lebanon since we last spoke. Want to start with the U.S.-France brokered ceasefire. Ceasefire is in air quotes. Between yeah. Hezbollah and Israel, that supposedly is in effect, but apparently actually not, which we'll get to in a moment. But I want to start with what is at the center of the deal, and that's the 2006 United Nations Security Resolution numbered 1701. What is that?
This says that that essentially there'll be a buffer zone in southern Lebanon where Israeli forces, yeah, they withdraw from the Lebanese border, but that also Hezbollah, they withdraw from southern Lebanon as well. And that, and the idea is here to provide a kind of security for, you know, Israeli communities on the other side of the border. This rests on two things. One is the presence of an armed UN force called UNIFIL, and on the Lebanese military. Now, you know, UNIFIL has, I mean, there's a lot to say, but one thing to say is that actually UNIFIL forces have, in fact, been shot and at least hurt, I think possibly killed in this past year by Israeli forces. So that shows you what Israel thinks of that UN force. The Lebanese military itself has been, I mean, the whole Lebanese state has really been hollowed out, you know, from the beginning. I mean, Lebanon was essentially crafted, the Lebanese state was crafted by France and by other powers to always be weak, which is precisely why we've seen the emergence of forces like Hezbollah playing the role of a state, because the state has largely been absent. And so, you know, everybody knows that it's a bit of a fantasy that you know, there'll be this kind of magical force that somehow establishes the peace. It's just not a real thing.
Well, that's what I was going to get to. I mean, the, you know, in terms of Lebanon being able to do any of it, there's so much to say. The Lebanon being able to do anything that's in here, the economy, infrastructure, was in shatters before this latest incursion by Israel. They are literally fundraising to repair, and the incursion hasn't stopped. And so it's like, this is a bunch of fluff on paper, and everybody knows that, I assume, including Hezbollah.
Yeah, I mean, just like, let's go to like on a super basic level. This is true in my life, and I'm sure it's true in the life of a lot of your listeners. I mean, the number of just fundraisers, of individuals hitting me up, you know, support my GoFundMe for mutual aid in Lebanon. You know, that's because there is no Lebanese state. Do you know what I mean? Like, people in Lebanon and in the diaspora are fundraising for basic necessities because, you know, there's really nothing there. There's a kind of shell of a state that was always meant to be weak. I mean, again, on a very basic level, if there was a Lebanese state, it could have done something about, you know, this another massive Israeli bombardment. You know, there has not been kind of air defense or anything like that. So, yeah, I mean, this, it, not only is this quote unquote ceasefire, you're right to put it in quotes, it's based on this kind of fantastical thinking, but we also have to talk about the reality of the U.S. brokering a so-called ceasefire after allowing one side to just completely brutalize the other. I mean, and I bring it up whenever we have the opportunity, this horrific pager attack that Israel carried out. I mean, inventing new forms of violence. And the U.S. said, yeah, that kind of thing was a daring move. They didn't talk about the obvious violations of international law. The assassination of Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, the U.S. said, yeah, the world is better off without him. I mean, that's the United States. That's the force that brokered this so-called ceasefire. And I think it tells us what we need to know about the ceasefire itself.
And to that end, there's this body that has been created to sort of oversee this process, hosted by the UN, staffed by the United States government and France. And this is supposed to be the body to which both the Lebanese and the Israeli governments can report if there's been a violation of the ceasefire. And go ahead. Yes, please.
Well, sorry. I was just going to say, those violations are already happening.
Right. Like, so 50 times on Israel's part.
I mean, this is like the kind of doublespeak. And I just want to assure, you know, folks listening, like, you're not wrong when you hear on the news, as I heard on NPR the past couple of days, the phrase, Israel carried out attacks in Lebanon today, but despite that, the ceasefire holds. And you're like, wait a minute, those are two contradictory, the end of that sentence contradicts the beginning of that sentence. So you're not wrong, you know, you're correct, there's a contradiction there. And so essentially we have, it's a ceasefire as long as Israel and the U.S. say it's a ceasefire.
The plan has phases. Can you walk us through them? We're supposedly in phase one, which is 60 days. What's supposed to be happening right now? In addition to Israel supposed to stop bombing places.
Right. Well, that's another really interesting and important point, because part of this is, it's not just that Hezbollah is supposed to stand down and withdraw whatever its materiel from southern Lebanon, but Israeli forces are supposed to be withdrawing back across the border, and they have been quite slow in doing that, Kat. And so when the ceasefire was announced, of course, the many, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in Lebanon have been displaced, especially from the south, but throughout the country. And folks, you know, again, especially from the south, I mean, in the south, whole villages have just been emptied of people as they've fled. And so people are returning, and Israel's saying, well, wait, you can't return yet. We're not done withdrawing. Lebanon is a beautiful country. The geography is quite small, Kat. It doesn't take long, actually, to drive from southern Lebanon back across the border to Israel. So the fact that Israel's dragging its feet in this so-called, you know, first phase, again, I think it really, it's an indicator of what the ceasefire is about. It's essentially saying that Israel has the right to do whatever it wants. And if there can be any perceived violation by Hezbollah, then we have a problem with the ceasefire. And in fact, the Israeli attacks that Israeli forces have carried out, they've said, well, these are preemptive strikes because Hezbollah is about to violate the ceasefire. That's not how a ceasefire works. You can't imagine that one side's about to violate it and therefore you attack. You know, it is in fact Israel that's violating the ceasefire. But this whole thing is so, the power reality is so incredibly lopsided in a way that violates the concept of ceasefire. I mean, the concept of ceasefire is two sides sitting down, you know, and saying in a kind of mutual way, here's what we're going to honor. And that's just not what's happening.
And then I guess the other thing, and this will be my last point on this, when I read that this body is hosted by the United Nations, I just have flashed on how many times Netanyahu has gone and cussed everybody at the United Nations out over the past year. And any attempt to hold Israel accountable whatsoever for the genocide has been met with claims, you know, accusations of the entire body being anti-Semitic. I just, none of it makes sense to me. And so I'm wondering, I guess, from you, the point and purpose of the charade. Like, who wins? who benefits from this performance that we're all witnessing on the world stage?
You know, this is extremely important because in a few weeks' time, you know, we are going to see an administration come into the White House that very explicitly says, we're against international law. We don't believe in the UN. You know, the whole thing should go. And what we have now is an administration that claims to believe in international law, that claims to uphold it. And so this is why it's so important to flag the actual reality in the way that you are doing, because the U.S.'s boy, Netanyahu, he comes before the U.N. to say, you know, you're all anti-Semitic, to denounce it. I mean, he's like, I will come to the U.N. to denounce you, and then we will use the U.N. when it's useful for us in this kind of functional way. Honestly, it is in a lot of ways a kind of crash course in what international law is for the United States. It's a great thing when it's useful for maintaining the supremacy of the U.S. and its allies. But then the moment there's any of the kind of accountability for the U.S. or its allies, all of a sudden it's useless. All of a sudden it's anti-Semitic. All of a sudden it's unfair. And we see that not only in how they're talking about Lebanon, but the fact that the International Criminal Court has issued warrants for the arrest of Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, the Israeli Minister of Defense. And the U.S. has said, yeah, we don't recognize the ICC's jurisdiction. The International Court of Justice has said Israel's violating the Genocide Convention, and the U.S. needs to take steps to recognize that. And the U.S. says, yeah, we think that the steps are sufficient. We've decided, because Israel's investigating itself, and we believe in those investigations. That's not how international law works, but that's how the U.S. wants to use it.
And staying on the futility of President Joe Biden, right after the announcement that the U.S. and France had brokered this quote-unquote ceasefire deal between Hezbollah and Israel, Joe said on X that the U.S. would immediately make another push with regional powers for a ceasefire in Gaza, of course, involving the release of hostages, the removal of Hamas from powers. Of course, that's what he would say. What is your assessment of what he's saying, where that stands? And I tag on to the end of that, like everywhere I'm seeing, or in a lot of places I'm seeing folks saying, well, Trump's coming, and so a ceasefire is more likely. And I'm like, really? Huh. But I'd love to get your take.
Yeah, I don't see any evidence that a ceasefire is likely under Trump at all. I mean, let's please, you know, with love, friends, let's disabuse ourselves of that notion. I mean, if a ceasefire happens under Trump, it will not be because of Trump. It will be because of other factors. You know, and when we're talking about a ceasefire in Gaza, again, I think it's so useful actually that you began with Lebanon, because essentially, I think what we've seen is Israel has said, you know what, we've basically achieved what we wanted to in Lebanon for now. We have killed senior leadership of Hezbollah. We have bombed a largely defenseless country and set back a city, Beirut, that has suffered so much. You know, and we've used that to demonstrate our power. We've field tested new ways of warfare, and we're satisfied, you know? And so, yeah, now we can have a quote unquote ceasefire. They may or may not decide the same thing in Gaza. They may say, you know what, we've achieved what we want to achieve, more or less. I mean, again, I'm pointing to these would appear to be a plan to build a permanent Israeli base in the middle of the Gaza Strip, bifurcating it, the north from the south. And if they're saying, you know, there may be a conversation that says, yeah, we'll accept a quote unquote ceasefire on our terms, which again is not actually a ceasefire. You know, ceasefire is a mutual agreement that is negotiated, and it requires compromises on two sides. And we can problematize, you know, these are not two equal sides, et cetera, but on the most basic level, you know, a ceasefire involves some compromise. And so if Israel says, we have sufficiently forcibly removed people from northern Gaza through starvation, through using all kinds of new tech to slaughter people, we've got our military stationed where we want it to.
be. We've destroyed every university campus in Gaza. We've attacked every medical facility. Yeah, we've decided we're ready for a ceasefire. That's within the realm of possibility. But again, you know, it would be a ceasefire on Israel's terms. And the number of times that the White House has said a ceasefire is right around the corner has been so many that A, I'll believe it when I see it. And B, given that rhetoric and given what Israel has actually done, the use of so-called negotiations have not been about achieving the aim of a ceasefire, in my opinion, but have instead been about providing cover for Israel to do what it wants to do. So that's what I think we're seeing, unfortunately. And once again, it's on the movements to win things like an arms embargo and a ceasefire and humanitarian aid, because the White House seems to have no appetite for that at all.
Curry, last question, Fred. I'm going to let you go and move on to my next guest. United States President-elect Donald Trump has selected Lebanon-born billionaire Massad Boulos as his senior White House advisor. Massad also happens to be his daughter's father-in-law, but as the White House advisor for Arab and Middle Eastern affairs, citing the work that he did do during the Trump campaign to reach out to Arab Americans during the election. What do we know about this dude? What are our concerns?
You know, I will admit I don't know much about this individual, given what I know about Trump's other picks and his tendencies. Let's just say I'm not inspired. So, you know, I think the challenge remains. We've got to build the resistance, and for better or for worse, we've had a lot of practice, you know, in the past year plus. And so it's time to deepen it, and it's time to step it up going into what is coming, because we already know. We already know.
Yeah, we do. All right, Curry Peterson-Smith, thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you soon, I bet.
Yes, thank you, Kat. Peace.
Curry Peterson-Smith is the Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches U.S. empire borders and migration. We're going to continue Palestine Post with Rami, an organizer with the Bay Area chapter of the Palestinian Youth Movement, a transnational grassroots independent movement of Arab and Palestinian youth struggling for the liberation of their homeland from the Bay to Palestine. Good morning, Rami.
Good morning, Kat.
Thank you for joining me. I know it's early. I actually want to start by getting your take on what I spent a lot of my conversation with Curry about, and that is the U.S.-France brokered, air quotes, ceasefire deal between Hezbollah and Lebanon. And I've got some very specific questions, but I think I'll just let you free speak your response, and then I'll tug threads out of that.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Kat. Yeah, this has definitely been top of mind. I have to say, you know, with what we've seen in Lebanon and what we've seen in Gaza, it's been relieving to see any like cessation of hostilities. I mean, we can't say that in its entirety, but right before, you know, the quote unquote ceasefire, they were striking Beirut, bringing entire residential buildings to the ground. So like, it has been relieving to see the people of Lebanon return to their homes, honestly. And this is all that I want for Gaza. But what the people of Lebanon returned to was their homes were destroyed. They were laying their loved ones to rest, and they were able to embrace the land that they continue to liberate from Zionist and imperialist aggression. And the cost of this war has been high. The destruction of infrastructure, the death toll, the displacement has been at a scale that's been unprecedented in any previous war on Lebanon, and this has really been the cost of confronting Zionism, and it shows how Israel is the biggest threat to our region, and how Zionism out of the Middle East is unsustainable, and its departure, Zionism's departure in the Middle East, is inevitable. And it, of course, it brings up questions about what this means for Gaza, right? Especially with no Northern Front. The Northern Front has been critical in terms of taking energy from the Zionist entity and displacing it, right? That's what we do in the belly of the beast. We are fighting imperialism and Zionism from our positionality. And we've already seen Israel break the ceasefire over 50 times. We saw that letter from France even commenting in 4 days. And so what this feels like is this kind of argument that was used in, you know, near October 7th of like this return to normalcy, that like there was a ceasefire before October 7th kind of energy that the Zionists really want us to accept, that while they continue to desecrate our lands and our people, the people aren't allowed to respond or resist. That's how it's been feeling for me.
You know, Rami, I wasn't going to go here because there's so much to talk about, but you sort of opened the door, so I'm going to. And I know sometimes, mm-hmm. like, when folks ask me, right, well, how do I talk to my so-and-sos about, you know, Black liberation struggle or police violence? I'm like, oh, God, read a book. So I apologize in advance. But, you know, like a lot of people, I was with my family over the last few days, and that's, you know, always exhausting for a variety of reasons. But we entered into this political conversation, and we were talking about everything, and then Israel, you know, the genocide came up, and one of my relatives very quickly tried to shut down the conversation, right? So I think that's just third rail. And I know it's weird because I mean, I talk about this all the time, but I always start any conversation I have with anybody about the genocide just assuming that you're on the right side, because it's hard for me to fathom anything different. And my God, especially if you're Black, right? Like, I'm just like, I don't see how you align yourself with Israel if you're Black in this country. But I sat across from my relative and listened to them regurgitate things like, well, there was a ceasefire on October 6th. What were some of the other ones? You know, they just don't want peace. Well, they've elected this terrorist government. And I was so angry. Like all of my well-groomed, trained speaker, make political points, shut people down, it all went away. Next thing I know, I'm screaming F Zionists.
Yeah.
But what I realized though, and this is I'm getting to my point as quickly as I can, was that I think for a lot of us, probably not you, but for a lot of us, I think that we, when we think about the people that are in support of genocide, like we see the foaming at the mouth, spitting Israeli American Zionist, right?
Yep.
This relative is a well-educated, well-spoken, college degree, retired early millionaire, not too much older than me. And I said to my daughter, I said, that's why. I said, because she votes. That's who they're catering to. That is the face of neoliberalism that is allowing this, that allows Democrats, Republicans, whoever, to continue to murder women and children with impunity. Yeah. Hoping to get your reflection on that. It was in my head. I was like, oh, I'm talking to the wrong people.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you are totally right. This is really the crowd that, because you can have all the education that, you know, you want to have. You can read the books. You can be as up to speed on, like, the genocide as much as possible. But if return to normalcy, whatever that means to you, is sufficient, is an okay status quo, there needs to be some investigation that's happening, because the status quo, and we can say this for Palestine, we can say this for the United States, the status quo is unsustainable for us. And for the people that believe that it's sustainable, it's because it's sustainable for them. And that's the reality, is that people who benefit from the status quo and neoliberalism, and it's usually those, you know, it's usually, you know, what MLK referred to as the white moderate, which has translated completely into class now, is what is the true detriment. It's the people in the middle that want or accept this status quo and this normalcy for what it is. And that normalcy is death.
Yeah, I mean, I was just really clear. I was like, you're just regurgitating the CNN and MSNBC, but I failed to convert someone to our side that night. That was, the response was not, I wasn't ready. Rami, I want to ask you, because I don't have too much more time with you, but you know, the HR 9495, which puts all of our funding in jeopardy at the will or nil of the federal government. And in this moment, right, concerned, of course, about organizations that are fighting for a free Palestine and those organizations that support them. And we have seen the first hit. The Biden administration is withholding federal funding from the Climate Justice Alliance. For folks who don't know, that's a national coalition. It's got 100 community environmental groups. It was one of 11 organizations that was designated for EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, funding. And the only group of the 11 grantees that has spoken out about Palestine, and now the only one that hasn't received its funding. Your thoughts?
Yeah. This is what I'm seeing is kind of the first rollout or the kind of normalization of this policy. And what I think is the most concerning about this is how widely encouraged and accepted it is on both, you know, both party lines. We are seeing this return to McCarthyism 100%. We're seeing the way that voicing your support for the Palestinian people, or just honestly merely against, you know, a genocide, is one, contested, and two, worthy for you to be stripped of your livelihoods, your funding, your ability to enact change, legislation, etc. And what I, you know, I wish I could say I don't understand this, but I do understand this, is that this is being done in the last 2 months of this Democratic presidency. Like, I want to scoff at it and be, you know, outraged about it, but it almost, like, the way that the Republican, the Democratic parties, the elite, the ruling class are so aligned. And we've seen this, obviously, for the past year of this genocide, for the fueling of this genocide by the Biden-Harris administration. This is like the one of the issues that really unites the Republican and the Democratic Party, is their will to destroy our movement. It's frankly impossible. You can't destroy, you know, the will of the masses like that. But the Biden administration is really setting the Trump administration up pretty well right now. And it's pretty, you know, I wish I could say I'm surprised. I'm not surprised, but it's a contradiction. I hope really pisses people off. And it's a contradiction I hope people can point to say, this is what it means to have a party that does not care about you, that does not, that it acts in the exact same way that the Republican Party does, and is actually ushering the way in for these kinds of policies.
And I think it's a lesson for a lot of us in terms of, like, And hopefully not, you know, I don't know the CJA's books about the diversification of funding. I mean, we saw this in 1998 mm-hmm. when Newt Gingrich, I don't think you were even a twinkle then, I don't think, but where Gingrich voted for a bill that banned federal funding to substance, you know, any organization that did any work with substance abuse, right? And a lot mm-hmm. of those organizations are prevention or harm reduction. And so a lot of these organizations woke up and their entire budgets were gone. Mm-hmm. which is really when like folks started to look at diversification of funds. And so this is a reminder, right, that mm-hmm. the Revolution Inc. will be funded by the federal government. And B, you know, that we've got to be really thinking about, and I say this all the time, that, you know, the right puts skin in the game. They do. They put skin in the mm-hmm. game. And the left had better get busy about doing the same thing. Want to ask you about local politics. And by local, I mean Oakland. New, more conservative council soon, in a couple of months, few months, a new mayor, a couple new mayors over the next couple of months, and probably a more conservative local district attorney, right? And I bring that up because of the difference between, you know, what's happening to the Golden Gate 26 and what happened to, you know, folks on this side of the bridge that shut down things as well. I think mm-hmm. a lot of that had to do with the DA that was sitting behind the desk. We're just wondering if there have been any early conversations about how local election results have impacted the way you're thinking about resistance in 2025.
Wow, 2025. Yeah. I mean, specifically, you know, we've had a fight in the city of San Francisco this past year. And we have seen the way that, you know, even with, I like to say people are so radical in the Bay Area, like the masses are so radical in the Bay Area, because we see what the like most liberal, the most quote unquote left of the Democratic Party or of the liberal elite looks like here. And what it looks like is punishing our movement, right? Putting us in a legal bind for months, you know, to try to take away our energy and to try to take away our momentum. So, you know, these local elections have really been top of mind, but we've also seen what it's been like to have such an unfriendly local government, right? I mean, almost the entirety of the city of San Francisco has really imposed a huge roadblock. And we might see that happening in Oakland. But what I can say about, you know, a positive, maybe to put a spin on this in terms of local elections, is we're seeing divestment resolutions pop up everywhere. And we're seeing that happen in the city of Oakland too. And this is something that's going to pick up a lot of steam and I think is going to be really successful, because what we know is that when we show up, and we organize and we organize a mass campaign around divesting from death, it doesn't, the power of the people on a local level is what's going to take us really far. And we're already seeing that starting specifically in the city of Oakland. We're seeing Oakland divest. So this is a really actually, you know, in the midst of the recalls, I could go on and on about the impact of these tech billionaires, the way that they have transformed the landscape of being able to just impose a recall. We've seen this in the past couple of years. We saw it with Jason Boudin. We're seeing it with Pamela Price. But the, you know, the positive is that we're still able to pick up these campaigns. We're still going to fight and urge that every institution that is complicit in the murder of the Palestinian people is, you know, we charge them with genocide, and we're going to make sure that they sever their ties with Zionism. And that's our job on a local level, is in the midst of what we see in terms of the recalls of the mayors and the DA, is that our goal becomes clear, and that's to cut ties with Zionism on a local level. That's what we got to do.
Well, what a lot of these folks don't understand, because they didn't live here until just a couple years ago, and some of them still don't live here, is that when you come for us, There's definitely a response. And so, Rami, I look forward to being in the streets with you very, very soon. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Kat. It's been great talking to you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.